Good morning. I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Wednesday, the 8th of May. 100 hunger strikers, actually lawyers say there may be 120, a majority of the 166 remaining inmates at Guantanamo are starving themselves. The president has said Guantanamo hurts us in terms of our international standing, and on his second day in office, he ordered the prison to be closed within a year. Obviously, that did not happen, and he blames Congress, some will say, with some justification for that. But is there a way for this facility to be closed? Is it possible to resettle detainees in their home countries or in other nations? Is this a matter of political will on the part of the president? The president did pledge last week to renew his push for Congress to reduce restrictions on prisoner transfers. This hour of the program, we'll be talking about this issue and welcoming your phone calls. We have two guests with us. Jonathan Hafitz is associate professor at Seton Hall Law School, author of Habeas Corpus After 9/11, Confronting America's New Global Detention System. He is co-editor of the Guantanamo Lawyers, Inside a Prison, Outside the Law, and he has served as counsel in major national security detention cases, including one which secured the release of a Guantanamo detainee. He has previously been a senior attorney at the ACLU's National Security Project and a litigation director at NYU's Brennan Center for Justice. Professor Hafitz, thank you very much for joining us for this discussion. Professor Hafitz, are you there?
Oh, I'm here.
I'm sorry, I had you on the wrong line.
Yes, hi.
Hi, thanks. Thanks for being with us.
It's a pleasure, yeah.
Pleasure to have you here. Jason Brozek is also with us. Jason was with us a couple of weeks ago as we talked about this issue, and we said, please come back. He is assistant professor of government, and he is also professor of international affairs at Lawrence University. And Professor Brozek, thank you for joining us once again.
Hi, Kathleen. Thanks for having me back on. It's good to be back.
Our pleasure.
And let me, I say, it's really an honor to be on with Jonathan, with Professor Hafitz. I've assigned his work in class before, and he's really made important contributions to the national discussion on these issues. It's really an honor and kind of intimidating to be on with him.
I think he'll do just fine. How about that, Professor Hafitz? He assigns your work in his classroom. That's good news, huh?
Too kind. Thank you very much.
Yeah. We'll be welcoming phone calls for both our guests. Our phone number, as always, is 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org. And you can send messages on our Facebook page, which may be the best way today. And that's the Kathleen Dunn Show. Professor Hafitz, let's start with you. How many hunger strikers are there right now? How many people are being force-fed? How many are in hospital?
Well, it's hard to know the exact figures. I mean, there are the reports are that there are more than 100 hunger strikers, people on hunger strike now, which is, well over 50%, well over half of the remaining prisoners there. A number are in hospital. I've heard the figure being around 10, but I've heard it being higher than that as well.
And people are on hunger strike for what reason? Is it just an accumulation of years, or did things get worse over the last few months?
Well, I think it's both. It's the immediate cause is the fact that the government seems to be, the Defense Department seems to be tightening up on security. There was a search where supposedly one of the guards ruffled through the Quran, and so something touched off the hunger strike. There was some precipitating cause, but there's also the underlying cause, which I think everyone agrees is the fact that these individuals have been held for more than 10 years in most cases without charge and with really no sense of when, if ever, they're going to leave the island. And the problem is particularly acute with respect to 86 of the detainees, more than half, who've actually been cleared for release by the Obama administration, yet still remain there as a result of the administration's lack of ability to take actions, roadblocks Congress has put in the way, and just, I think, a kind of a general backlash against Guantanamo detainees.
86 detainees cleared for release, meaning they had no part of any kind of terrorism plot, no involvement with terrorism?
Well, that's right. I mean, actually, in fact, only a handful have actually been the detainees have been accused of any specific terrorism plot. There are others who the administration says, because of their you know, connections to Al-Qaeda or other groups pose a threat. That's about 50 or so of the detainees. But these other, these 86 detainees are people who, when Obama took over and promised to close the prison, he established a task force to review the status of the detainees and what should be done with them. And the conclusion was that, that these detainees did not pose a threat to the United States. They did not pose a national security threat, at least at the present moment, and that they should be repatriated. The United States should not continue to detain them. So that's why I use the word clear. These are individuals the United States says, you know, don't pose a danger to us, yet they remain.
Professor Brozek, the president said recently that Guantanamo hurts us in terms of our international standing. Would you agree, and how are we being hurt in international standing?
Yeah, I do agree. I think there's a lot of global political significance here. I think Guantanamo is a powerful symbol. I think that the administration's efforts to improve the living conditions there, and there have been substantial efforts, the administration's efforts to end torture, I don't think they can shake that powerful symbolism of Guantanamo. And these things, things in the same vein, Guantanamo plus Abu Ghraib, extraordinary rendition, the CIA black sites, all of these undermine our global reputation as a country that respects human rights. They undermine U.S. soft power around the globe. And going further, and maybe we can talk about this later, and there have been some suggestions that it's also been this really powerful recruiting tool for organizations like Al-Qaeda and others.
The president has blamed Congress for this with some justification, Professor Hayfitz, or not?
Yes. I mean, there's some justification, but I think the president has tried to place too much of the blame on Congress. After the president promised to close Guantanamo and ordered the prison's closure following his election and inauguration, he did not take steps when he could have to seek the prisons, to seek the, you know, the transfer of the prisoners. And what happened was there was a backlash that developed in Congress to bar the transfer of detainees to the United States for any purpose, whether for to release them, to try them in a federal court, or to hold them in sort of a similar, similar type of law of war detention at a federal facility. And so Congress barred, when Congress barred the president from bringing detainees to the United States, that made it difficult to close Guantanamo. Plus, Congress also put restrictions on the president's ability to transfer detainees to other countries through a series of onerous certification requirements. Now, Congress is responsible in that respect by really trying to tie the president's hand and limit the president's options. However, I think two things are important. First of all, President Obama signed these measures, these bills that Congress had passed, defense appropriations bills that put the restrictions on. So the president, essentially agreed with him. I mean, he chose not to exercise a veto power, even though these were, contrary to his order to close Guantanamo and really contrary to the security interests of the United States. And second, even with the existing restrictions, the president still has authority to transfer detainees to foreign countries as long as they can go through those certification requirements. And so there is leeway under the existing requirements to certify individuals for transfer, to say that steps are being taken to try to prevent any kind of recidivism. But the president has not used this power to get a waiver of the transfer restrictions at all. And so, the transfers have come basically to a dead standstill.
Mm. I've read, Professor Brozek, that the president can't find any country that will take these people.
Well, there's a handful of folks that are Yemeni citizens and folks from other Gulf Coast states where we know where they're from, and They are in Kuwait, for example. They've spent millions of dollars building a rehabilitation facility, and we aren't able to transfer those detainees back. In some cases, because the countries won't take them. In other cases, because this National Defense Authorization Bill that Congress passed requires very strict guidelines for monitoring, and as Professor Hayford said, for ensuring there's no recidivism, and so we aren't able to transfer detainees to those states because they don't have these policies in place. And then there are a handful of detainees that can't easily be released because they pose a security threat. They also can't easily be tried because the evidence against them either was gathered through torture or is highly classified. So even if we could, or President Obama took the executive authority to transfer the half or so of the detainees that have been cleared for release, the underlying problem of Guantanamo is still there. There are still dozens and dozens of detainees that that can't be transferred.
Professor Hayfitz, tell me about your securing the release of one of the Guantanamo detainees.
Well, this was a case of one of the more troubling cases at Guantanamo involving an Afghan young teenager named Mohammed Jawad, who was detained after based on the allegation that he had thrown a grenade at a U.S. military vehicle near Kabul. He was, after he was taken into custody, he was brutally treated by Afghan authorities, transferred to the U.S., and shifted around. First, he was held at Bagram, and then he was brought to Guantanamo. He was subjected to very abusive interrogation techniques that a military judge, in fact, found were constituted cruel and inhuman treatment, including being, you know, moved around dozens of times in the middle of the night to break up his sleep, prolonged isolation, physical abuse. So in any event, there was they basically, after through the torture tactics, were able to extract a false confession from him. He was then tried. They then tried to try him before a military commission. These are the war crimes tribunals at Guantanamo, military courts that are set up specifically to try the detainees there for supposed violations of the laws of war. And there were a number of problems with Mr. Jawad's case. First of all, what he was accused of doing, that is throwing a grenade at a military, at a tank, it's not a war crime. It could be a crime for a civilian that is not a soldier to attack a military target, but it's not. It's just a crime under either U.S. law or maybe Afghan law, but it's not a war crime. Second of all, the basis of the case, the allegations were based on evidence that had been obtained through torture. And so we try, in addition, there was problems with the fact that Mr. Jawad was a child, and so he was being tried for war crimes when he was a child, which is against international conventions and customary international law. And so in any event, the military, the case actually broke down in the military system because one of the military judge basically said, look, this is not a war crime, and it was threw out the false confessions. So even after the case derailed in the military system, the government, this is now under President Obama, that we're going to try to hold him as an enemy combatant. We're going to continue to detain him, even if we're not going to try him of a war crime. And so we went to federal court under the habeas corpus right that had been recognized by the Supreme Court, and were able to persuade the district judge to force the government to send him home based on the fact that there was no evidence against him, no evidence that he had thrown the grenade, no evidence that he was someone who was detainable under the laws of war. And so after years of litigation in the military system and then again in the federal court system, he was released and sent back to Afghanistan.
Mm. Why would it be, I'm thinking about the length of time here, Professor Brozek, why would it be that we've only had three people convicted, six are currently facing trial, including the alleged mastermind of the September 11 attacks? It would seem to me as though you would want those people, those tribunals, to move ahead quickly, long before 11 years after the attacks, so that you could make a statement about to the world about how awful these attacks were.
I think some of the delay comes from the kind of information that's used in these cases. And my understanding of the new tribunal that's been built at Guantanamo Bay is this is a high security tribunal, militarized courtroom in a sense, where the judges have to carefully go through the information to find out what is classified and what can be used, and what the attorneys are able to hear, what the suspects are able to hear, what the press is able to hear, and so this is a much more careful process. I don't think, in some ways, we don't want this to be a fast process. We don't want these to be kangaroo courts where 2 weeks after 2 weeks after arrest, suspects are convicted. So 11 years is certainly unreasonable, but I also don't think we want to go too far in the opposite direction either.
Well, what about those military tribunals, Professor Hafetz?
I think that they are fundamentally and inherently flawed, and they will never be able to deliver due process or impose justice in a credible manner. I mean, they have been, they started out when, at the beginning, they really were truly kangaroo courts that were established to secure convictions. They allowed in evidence obtained by torture. They were totally impartial. Now, because of years of litigation, public pressure, the tribunals have improved. The most recent version is under a 2009 statute that President Obama helped get passed, which brought a number of different improvements to the tribunals. But at the end of the day, I think they're still fundamentally flawed. Their jurisdiction is overbroad. They have the power to try offenses that are not recognized as war crimes under international law. In fact, all seven of the convictions that have been obtained thus far, most have been by pleas, were for things like conspiracy or material support for terrorism, which, while maybe violations of the federal criminal code, are not violations of international law subject to trial and military commissions. And there are also a number of procedural problems that persist. The inequality of funding between the defense and the prosecution, overclassification, the use of hearsay that makes it difficult to prove that evidence was obtained by torture or coercion. Mm-hmm. And so there are just a host of problems. And so and if you contrast that, the federal courts have proven time and again that they are capable of delivering justice in a way that's fair, that's transparent, and that's credible. I mean, if you just look at the way the suspect in the Boston Marathon bombing, how that case is being handled. It's in federal court. It's proceeding. There's a established system of rules, of procedures, of legitimacy. And you look at that, and you look at all of the problems that have befallen the military commission trials, including the proceedings against the 9/11 mastermind. Alleged 9/11 mastermind Khalid Sheikh Mohammed. I mean, it's a stunning contrast, and there's no rational basis for trying important terrorism cases like the 9/11 case in a military commission rather than a federal court.
Mm-hmm. Jason, why are these detainees willing to die?
Well, boy, that's a difficult question. I think at some point it's desperation. I think it's a palpable sense of injustice, and I think there's so I'll say that one of the interesting parts of the story for me of the hunger strike is that it's really brought together strange bedfellows in a way. So the American Medical Association and the Anonymous group, for example, which just announced they have these ops that they run through Twitter, and just a couple of days ago announced hashtag op Gitmo. That's an effort to an effort in solidarity with the hunger strike. But the American Medical Association has, as far back as 1975, said that patients have the right to refuse food, and that force feeding is not only degrading and painful, but inhumane and unethical. And that's something that the president of the AMA reiterated in a letter to Secretary of Defense Hagel not too long ago. But the response to the hunger strike at Guantanamo can't just be an issue, or isn't just an issue of medical ethics. This is an issue of managing, containing, of finessing what's really a political spectacle. And the Obama administration, the Defense Department, they're very aware of the impact that the death from starvation would have. I'm sure they're very aware of Bobby Sands, the and his death. His death in 1981, which led to a wave of violence in the IRA conflict and really prolonged that conflict.
So, Jonathan, what do you think would happen if any of these on hunger strike detainees did die?
Well, I think it would be tragic, although, you know, it's not the would not be the first death at Guantanamo. There have been a number of deaths before. But I think it would, while tragic, I mean, it would increase the pressure for the United States to act. I mean, this is the problem that the United States can solve and certainly can mitigate in the short term through taking action with respect to the cleared detainees. I think that, at this point for the detainees, there's nothing left. I mean, there's nothing left for them to do. I mean, you've got people there who not only have they been there for more than a decade, but they've been cleared for release by the United States for more than 3 years. Mm-hmm. There's no basis under international law to hold these people. I mean, it's a violation of international humanitarian law, the law of war, and international human rights law, and yet they continue to remain. The courts are really doing nothing about it. Congress is just putting up roadblocks, and the president is really not taking steps to act, and so it's really the detainees and their hunger strike that have forced the world to pay attention again.
We welcome phone calls for both our guests. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Our email, if you'd like, don't use that. Use our Facebook page, which is The Kathleen Dunn Show. Our two guests are Professor Jonathan Haifetz, Associate Professor at Seton Hall Law School, author of Habeas Corpus After 9/11, Confronting America's New Global Detention System. He is co-editor of the Guantanamo Lawyers, Inside a Prison, Outside the Law. Jason Brozek is Assistant Professor of Government, and he's also a Professor of International Affairs at Lawrence University. What's the solution to all of this? Many levels to this story. 800-486-8655, our number. We'll start taking your phone calls momentarily here on the Ideas Network. Hour two of our program today happens to be Harry Truman's birthday, so that's why we scheduled this show for this day. The author of Double V, How Wars, Protest, and Harry Truman Desegregated America's Military. 65 years ago this year that Harry Truman did that, and the book is about that, but it's also about the long history and not very stellar history of how African Americans were treated from the Revolutionary War on, so that's coming up. Hour two of our show. Guantanamo, the pressure growing to close Guantanamo, why everything there is such a mess is what we're talking about this hour. And we go to phone calls, starting with Joseph in Milwaukee. Hi, Joseph.
Hi, thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I was just calling because I had heard a few months ago that the officer in charge of Guantanamo had requested an opinion from the Attorney General on whether he could deny health care to detainees. I was wondering if I'm remembering that right correctly, and if your guests knew anything about that.
Jonathan?
A letter from the attorney to the Attorney General. I'm not aware of the specific letter and opinion of the Attorney General on that point.
Okay, thank you.
Thanks very much, Joseph. Maji from Minnesota. Hi, Maji.
Hello, yes. Actually, it's this is a great country, and it has a great justice system. But what is done to the people in Guantanamo is actually not right. Many of them, they are innocent, and they never done anything wrong. They just grabbed them from the street and brought them here. Now, people already proven that they had done something wrong, you put them to trial. But the other ones, you get already honor them and release them and give them actually compensation for keeping them in 10 years or more in jail, destroying their lives. I mean, this is, you cannot just, if someone does something to you and you were innocent and he was guilty, then you take them to court and they compensate you. Now, these people, they were grabbed from the streets of Afghanistan in the broad year, some of them guilty, some of them not, some of them, they have belief, and you keep them 10, 11 years and, you know, torture them, and now they are on hunger strike. I think the innocent ones, they should be exonerated and given compensation for their misdeeds. The other ones put them on the trial.
Jason Brozek.
So I think the question is whether whether there are options beyond releasing with compensation or trying, and I think that's a great question, and I think a perfectly fair one. And in the U.S. justice system, no. And I think that brings me to a thought that I had about the Obama administration's executive order in 2008 or 2009 to close Guantanamo. And it's not clear whether the administration planned this announcement poorly or announced that intention without fully understanding the political hurdles. But it is frustrating that they haven't invested really any serious political capital in pressuring Congress to overturn these new provisions or to reach out to the public to go around Congress. And there's been some suggestion by critics that the Obama administration is, if not relieved about Congress passing these restrictions, at least not frustrated, that this becomes a convenient screen for something that's less attractive than they first thought it might be. And now they can shift the blame for not being able to close Guantanamo onto Congress instead of facing this issue of releasing with compensation or finding a way to try or finding a home for these prisoners. They can push off the blame. It's an argument I've seen from critics recently.
The young man that you represented, Jonathan, was he given compensation?
No, he wasn't given compensation. And further, the United States has also done a poor job in trying to help integrate detainees who've been held for years, you know, whether rightly or wrongly, back into wherever, you know, the country that they're transferred to. But, you know, he wasn't given any compensation, and no one who's been detained in the war on terror has been given compensation or to be able to obtain compensation from the courts. And that's, you know, it's not because there have been trials and their claims that they were tortured or mistreated were proven false. It's because the government has opposed compensation and opposed the litigation of their claims through things like the state secrets doctrine. And so courts have not even, addressed the merits of their claims, and so there's been no compensation. I think that's another major failing of the United States' response in the war on terror.
Kenneth in Janesville, hi.
Hello. You know, we're forgetting what it was like in the Korean War when the Chinese communists were doing the terrible things to our prisoners, and then in the Vietnam War. But we're also forgetting what the election, the job won for President Obama was closing Guantanamo. That had a higher priority than the health care law. And, you know, without putting the black hats on the people that are responsible for turning all of that around, I mean, we've had two elections of Obama, where his first goal was to close Guantanamo, and there are people that are making us aware of the black hat in the world.
Professor Brozek.
Well, I think there are two hurdles, and I assume the Obama administration was aware of these going into it. One was the legacy inherited from President Bush, these detainees that couldn't be released and couldn't be tried. There's also the hurdle of the opposition in Congress that's now been codified into law. But these hurdles don't make it impossible. There was this fascinating op-ed by Noah Feldman yesterday. He's a professor of international law at Harvard, that made the case, I think convincingly, that Obama could act unilaterally and ignore Congress, that Congress has no authority to force the president to violate the Geneva Conventions or other international law. And so Congress is acting unlawfully by putting these provisions in the National Defense Authorization Act. I think the argument is there that these are hurdles, but this is not an impossible task if President Obama wanted to spend the political capital doing it. I think it's clear that he's interested in spending political capital elsewhere.
Could he act? Would you agree with that, Professor Heifetz? He could act unilaterally?
I fully agree. I mean, I think President Obama is not willing to spend the political capital. I think that's exactly right. You know, I'd add that, you know, he campaigned originally on a promise to close Guantanamo and benefited from that, you know, when he was running against John McCain. He also, and when he was originally elected, there were no obstacles in his path. I mean, when he first took office, there was nothing that would have stopped him from closing Guantanamo. Those obstacles came later. You know, and part of it is Obama was not smart. He did not kind of anticipate what might happen. He decided to sort of study the problem rather than take action. Mm-hmm. But I think he's acquiesced. I mean, he doesn't, you know, to some extent, I do think he's, you know, he's happy if the Guantanamo problem goes away. And the problem now for him is that I think the hunger strikes have kind of refocused broader attention on the fact that the prison has still not closed.
We go to Bob next in Oshkosh. Our number, by the way, lines are open for you, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Our Facebook page is the Kathleen Dunn Show. We're attention drawn, of course, to Guantanamo specifically because there are at least 100 hunger strikers at the facility, detainees, and some say more than that. Why are these detainees starving themselves? Why is it that the president blames Congress for this? And why is it that this facility cannot be closed and people sent back home? That's the question. Bob in Oshkosh, hi.
Hey, how are you doing this morning?
All right, Bob, how are you?
Yeah, getting my master's in political science, I did some research on the mechanisms to what appeared to be incite or prolong the initial stages of World War II. And one of the insights that I came out of that was that really the big money players, the big power players, never really get the national stage. Guantanamo has a very difficult time being closed due to the fact of the immense power of the money involved in keeping the war occupied. It's a tremendous, as everyone knows, from probably the wider thing would be a history of Abraham Lincoln's business in the Civil War about the individuals who were making a lot of profiteering. There's a tremendous amount of profiteering coming out of both the Afghanistan and the remnants of military presence around the world, and we all know that. But the bought and paid for Congress, in many respects, is probably not going to take much direction in closing Guantanamo, simply because as a hemorrhaging thing goes for the American public, as a profit-making thing for the arms industry. I'll take my comments off the air.
Thanks for the call. Jonathan?
Well, I think, I just would only add that I think that the financial incentives are closing Guantanamo are significant. It's a wildly expensive prison. This is something that's made it into President Obama's talking points about closing Guantanamo, so that there may be, you know, I think there may be perverse incentives for keeping it open. Clearly, the financial incentives for the United States as a whole would be to shut the prison down.
Well, you can't keep it open if everybody's died, right?
Well, that would be, eventually, people are going to die of old age at Guantanamo.
Right. If not of hunger strike before. My understanding is that authorities are seeking an extra $200 million to refurbish Guantanamo on top of the annual running costs, which are much more than would be for an ordinary prison. Does that decision have to be made soon? Do you know anything about this, Jason?
Well, So I don't know about that specific funding measure. I think the caller and Jonathan are both right that so new detainees in the war on terror are being held in federal prisons. There are two special units designated for this, one at the Supermax prison in Colorado. These are two special units for international terrorism cases. These are maximum security prisons. Prisoners are held there for a cost of about $25,000 a year, which is the pretty much the standard cost for housing a federal prisoner. The prisoner cost at Guantanamo is somewhere between $700,000 and $900,000 per prisoner per year. So this is not an inexpensive proposition. I don't think cost should be the primary consideration in what to do about Guantanamo, but it does point to the argument that this can be done in a much more efficient way, and in fact is being done in a much more efficient way. There have been no new detainees at Guantanamo since 2008. All of the more recent detainees are going into federal penitentiaries.
Mm-hmm. And how many more recent detainees are there, Jonathan? And are we questioning people, as some would say, in places all over the world still, holding people?
Well, I mean, this is one of the areas where President Obama has, I think, shifted away from the Bush administration, although the question is how much the practice has changed. I mean, Guantanamo is clear. There have been no, basically at this point, no one's coming in, although no one's really leaving the island either, but certainly there haven't been new prisoners. Although, you know, query what would happen under another administration in the future. But in terms of what's happening elsewhere, the United States is, you know, drawing down in troops in Afghanistan. Afghan prisoners are being transferred. Many have been. The remaining are being transferred to the Afghan government. The U.S. is continuing to hold non-Afghan prisoners, although I don't believe that detainee population is being added to. And what the Obama administration has done is to move away from detaining, picking up people and holding them in military detention, or at least outside of places like Afghanistan, and instead it's really relying on foreign partners in places in the Middle East, the Horn of Africa, to carry out detention, and then the administration is involved in interrogation and information sharing. But there's been a kind of a drawdown in basically U.S. global-wide detention under the Obama administration.
Do we have any idea of how many prisoners or people are being detained in various places? Is it hundreds or thousands? Or
in Afghanistan, it was more than 3,000, but most were Afghan nationals that are being returned to or have been returned to Afghan custody. There still are a small number of them. There are no exact figures. I think it's somewhere around 50 to 75, or some of the estimates of non-Afghan detainees who the U.S. Is continuing to hold. But overall, the number of individuals in U.S. custody is declined significantly.
Yeah, Bob, thanks for your call. Benny in Spring Valley. Hi, Benny.
Hi.
Hi.
I was wondering why, if we've got like 86 of these people have been found not guilty, and we're basically holding them for their own protection, why we have to keep them as prisoners? Why can't we give them some, humane conditions, build, apartment buildings or something like that?
Jason.
Well, until the recent hunger strikes, actually. So one of the things that I think is less well known about Guantanamo Bay is that the infrastructure has really changed over the last 10 years or so. These open air wire cages that we saw at the beginning, the Camp X-Ray, still there, but really now just part of the tours for visiting media. The prison now is a state of the art maximum security prison, plus this Camp 7 where some of the high value detainees are held, including Khalid Sheikh Mohammed and others. But until these recent hunger strikes, where there's been more of a crackdown on freedom, the majority of the detainees had access to communal areas, access to television and internet and Skype. The Department of Defense spent a lot of money recently building new soccer fields. So until recently, until the hunger strikes in the last few months, there was a lot of flexibility. There was a lot of freedom of movement in this new facility, which is really nothing like the orange jumpsuited people hunkered down in wire cages that were the images in 2002 and 2003.
Mm-hmm. How much information do we know we've been able to receive, if any, from Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, Jonathan?
Information, you mean how much information did we get through his interrogations,
yeah,
or information about his treatment? Or
no, information about through his interrogations.
Well, I mean, I think, you know, Khalid Sheikh Mohammed was, you know, subject to the CIA's so-called enhanced interrogation tactics, which are, you know, clearly constitute torture. He was waterboarded 182 times. I think the information that was obtained, we did not obtain, you know, valuable information from him through his, you know, through his waterboarding. In fact, some of the information that was obtained from Khalid Sheikh Mohammed was false and misleading. In fact, the courier who operated, a courier who ultimately is what led the United States to Bin Laden, Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, during his interrogations, has thrown the United States off the scent and had actually given different information about the courier that, you know, helped, that delayed or derailed, you know, the sort of manhunt for Bin Laden. But I think, you know, I mean, clearly, I think we did not gain information from Khalid Sheikh Mohammed by torturing him.
Mm-hmm. More phone calls in a moment. 800-486-8655 is our number, 800-486-8655. We're talking about Guantanamo, where more than 100 detainees are on hunger strike. There is pressure growing to close Guantanamo and many questions being raised. Why hasn't it been closed before now, and what are the obstacles to its closure? Our guests are Jason Brozek, Assistant Professor of Government and Professor of International Affairs at Lawrence University, Jonathan Hayfetz, Associate Professor at Seton Hall Law School, author of Habeas Corpus After 9/11, Confronting America's New Global Detention System, and he is co-editor of the Guantanamo Lawyers, Inside a Prison, Outside the Law. He has served as counsel in major national security detention cases, including one which secured the release of a Guantanamo detainee. More phone calls in a moment. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Hour two of our program, the author of Double V, How Wars, Protest, and Harry Truman Desegregated America's Military. Let's go to more phone calls. Kurt in Chippewa Falls. Hi.
Hi. If I can go back to the political capital comments earlier in the program, I have seen in the radio and in the pundits, in the newspaper, the columnists over the last several months since Obama's reelection, almost an eagerness on the part of the centrists and the left, the more left commentators, in which I count myself as far as that's concerned, a willingness to dump on Obama for failing to, you know, to be more vigorous in his on these issues, whether it's the Keystone Pipeline or Guantanamo or immigration, whatever the issue is for a particular commentator, you know, why isn't Obama being more vigorous about that? You know, you start to wonder how much political capital would he have if he were to, you know, equally vigorous on all these issues. The right wing and the, it seems that the commentators are laying off of the real problem, which is the obstructionists in Congress, you know, who have no limit to what they want to obstruct anything that Obama or the rest of us are trying to accomplish.
All right, let's go to Jason Brozek on that.
Oh, Kurt, I think you're exactly right. I don't think we should ever be letting Congress off the hook for this sort of delay and the current challenges of Guantanamo. I think what I would argue is that there's enough blame here to spread around. I think there's a lot of blame in a lot of places. Part of the blame is with Congress, absolutely. Part of the blame is with the Obama administration and choosing to put political capital elsewhere. And they did it for perfectly good reasons. I understand why. Part of the blame is with the American public too. This issue, this was a big issue in the 2008 election. This did not come up in the 2012. Campaign. Part of that is because the candidates didn't bring it up, and part of it was because the American public wasn't demanding it. And this is the power of the hunger strike, I think, is that this is putting the issue, mm-hmm. It's forcing the issue back on the radar of a lot of folks who would rather let it sink.
Yeah, it certainly puts it front and center again. Here's an email from Nancy in Janesville. Jonathan, for you, international law provides for victims obtaining justice through the courts, not just prohibitions against torture and bringing torturers to justice.
Well, that's absolutely correct. The Convention Against Torture, for example, which the United States and approximately 150 other countries have signed, requires that the courts be made available to provide the compensation, and also requires that states prosecute, torture that's been committed, neither of which, the United States has done. It's closed its civil courts for people to obtain remedies through things like the state secrets doctrine. And, I think there was not an effective effort to seek accountability, whether through criminal investigations or some other, even some kind of, official bipartisan committee to carry out the investigation. It was left to a not-for-profit organization, a nonpartisan group called the Constitution Project, which undertook a sweeping study of the Bush administration interrogation and detention practices, which it found constituted torture. But the U.S. government has not really done anything on the accountability front, whether, to go after the people who were responsible for torture or to provide compensation for those who were the victims.
Mm-hmm. Thanks, Kurt, for your call. Art in Milwaukee. Hi, Art.
Hi. Well, aside from the overwhelming human rights issues, the fact is that the agreement imposed on Cuba for U.S. to maintain Guantanamo explicitly states its exclusively used for two purposes, as a naval station and what they called a coaling station, which means a refueling station. So the whole thing is completely illegitimate based on our tenuous legal right to be there in the first place. It's a perpetual agreement, meaning that both sides have to agree to end it or it doesn't end in terms of our leasehold there. So anything longer than 99 years is disfavored or illegitimate under international law. And there was some discussion in Washington, not within the administration per se, that if we could ever get out of this situation and agree to return it to Cuba, that we could use as a transition the idea of having a joint project dealing with tropical disease research, which both Cuba and the U.S. would have a great interest in. And that would be a much better way to go in the long run.
Jason?
Well, so the 1903 treaty that Art is referring to, he's correct about that. I think that I have trouble in imagining a situation where even if we find a way to close down Guantanamo and transfer those detainees elsewhere back to U.S. soil, back to their home countries, I can't imagine a situation where the U.S. would give up this strategically important naval base in Cuba. The fact that it's such a power asymmetry between the U.S. and Cuba, that we have so much influence over Cuba, so much power over Cuba, means that we're not going to give up this strategic resource that we have, even if they would really like us to. But the question of how to use that and what is appropriate, these are difficult questions of international law. The question that Nancy asked about justice through the courts, this is also a question of where these individuals are housed at and what sort of personhood they have under international law. The question of unlawful enemy combatants, I think, is a really fascinating one. The Bush administration essentially created a third category of humanity under the Geneva Conventions, that these were neither non-combatants nor combatants, that these were unlawful enemy combatants. And so the argument was that we've created a new category of humanity, and we've put them in a place outside of U.S. jurisdiction. And when we put those two things together and mix those two things up, international law gets murky enough and gray enough that it creates these multi-decade arguments. Mm.
About 30 seconds left. Jonathan, considering what's happening at Guantanamo, is there vigorous attention being paid to solving this issue on the part of the administration like we've never seen before?
Well, I think there's more attention being paid than any time in the past several years, you know, sort of beyond the first year when it was a priority for the administration. To do it. So, yeah, I think that they are focusing on, and I do think you'll see some results. I do think you'll see at least some transfer of some cleared detainees. The high-level meeting between the United States and Yemen last week, most of the two-thirds of the cleared detainees are from Yemen, and the concerns about the security situation there have prevented their return. Obama has imposed a categorical ban on the transfer of any Yemen detainees, something that, prohibits transfers even without the congressional restrictions. So I think you'll see some. I think you'll see a little bit. How much is unclear.
Hmm. Thank you so much for being with us, both of you. Jonathan Haifetz, thank you. Jason Brozek, thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
Our pleasure to have both of you on talking about what's going on at Guantanamo. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing this hour. Thanks to Lisa Nalbandian for on-air production in our studios here in downtown Milwaukee. We will continue with Wednesday morning conversation after we get an update on all the latest news.